This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Hi, Jason Gibbs, Joy Production Manager. It's Radiothon time. We still need Joy and we need your support. If you appreciate our free podcast service, our voice for the LGBTI community globally, and the volunteers that make our service possible, please sign up, renew your Joy membership, or make a tax-deductible donation before June 30 to keep our service possible. You may win a prize. Head to joy.org.au and click on either the Become a Member or Donate tabs to support us. If you appreciate our podcast service, let us know in the comments section when making your donation. Joy Podcasts, where you want them, when you want them, at joy.org.au and on iTunes.
You're on Joy 94.9, Sunday Arts Magazine, Brennan and Neil with you, taking you through to 5pm. We are very, very honoured to welcome our next guest into the studio, Philip Adams. You're a very distinguished gentleman, aren't you?
It's just the grey hair, perhaps.
maybe. Looking very distinguished anyway.
But really, thank you for coming in and having a chat with us today.
Gentlemen, it's a pleasure.
And we're going to be talking about Ballet Lab a lot. And about a little bit of a move that you had recently. But, Philip, firstly, for people that might not know all about your background, you know, we're always interested in finding out where people got their start. So was there a point where you kind of got into the arts industry that you can pinpoint?
I have so many stories where about my career. But, you know, one that sort of fascinates people, and I'll just jump in really quickly I was raised in Papua New Guinea. Interesting.
Amazing.
Really flamboyant and exotic upbringing in Papua New Guinea. And I was like in the most bizarre moments of my childhood, I was hit by a car by accident, okay, running across a pedestrian crossing, and I broke my femur. Lucky me, I wasn't, you know, knocked sideways and flattened by a semi-trailer and, like, you know, never saw the end of that moment. But the physical therapy in Papua New Guinea at the time, this is the mid to late 60s, giving away my age, was quite backward. And so the doctor, once the little, you know, my little leg had come out of the plaster, suggested that I take up ballet,
right,
taught on Saturday mornings, okay, in the hut, outdoors on concrete, taught by a teacher who was coming out from London to strengthen the little leg into doing pliés and rondeaux and across the floor, El Petit Allegro. So that's actually how I started dancing by default. By a car accident that I got hit by a car, went, you know, after the plaster came off, went and did ballet class.
And as a young boy, how did you take that for the, I mean, like, was it just, did you jump in thinking this is fantastic, I love it, or was it just something new for you? Or?
You know, without hesitation, I think movement was always in my body, and in the way that I just remember starting with a pair of white tights and a black t-shirt, standing at the bar with my left hand holding the bar, and then beginning these exercises, which are called, you know, ballet class.
Yep.
And then it just was sort of part of my DNA ever since that moment. So, you know, it felt really natural. So there was never any questioning about me entering the dance world, or my parents being, you know, encouraging me to continue to always, you know, dance. Where we landed when we moved back to Australia, I was always in a dance school.
So they weren't thrown, you know, this was just supposed to be your recovery and now you want to do it full time.
Exactly.
They weren't thrown by it?
Yes. No, not at all. So, yeah, completely encouraged that, and that's the way it worked.
And so you just kept continuing.
This is lovely. It's talking about my life. And then we moved to Darwin, you know, in 1974, and I was actually in Cyclone Tracy. I mean, for the listeners out there who remember when Darwin was flattened on Christmas Eve 1974, so I was in that cyclone.
You enjoy courting disaster.
I know. Just like I had a whirlwind, you know, upbringing. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, after surviving that and sort of family trauma and losing everything, when we settled in Canberra, when I went to another dance school, and eventually, this is a very, very kind of really good sidetrack to how we're going to get, firstly, to my career, mm-hmm, and where into the VCA and living in New York, etc. When I left school at 18 from Canberra, I hitchhiked to Sydney and got a job, get ready for it, on the Mike Walsh Show, Channel 9, dancing as a backup dancer for Olivia Newton-John and Johnny Farnham. It was my first job, and that's Philip at 19 years old.
Well, without giving my age away, I remember all of that too, Philip. So I'm actually following your career at the moment. I think it was like, okay, I know where I was at that point in time. And so...
And was there a strong industry at that point? You know, getting that role, was it unheard of, or was it kind of
in the commercial industry? I mean, right. I'd always done tap and jazz, right, and ballet, so I had like quite a good base of technique, and that did help. And being 19 and having youth on your side and a lot of energy, and for those listeners out there, let's just trace back to 1985, what Sydney was like at that time in the commercial world, and sort of the freedom and the so much more radical than it is today, let's say. And so I just happened to know a friend that knew a friend, and I auditioned, and I got a job dancing on the Mike Walsh Show. Yeah, as a backup dancer for all of their celebrities that used to come on and sing.
That's incredible. Well, we're going to continue your story, Philip Adams, after a few messages on Joy 94.9. It's Sunday Arts Magazine. Become a member or renew your membership during Radiothon and go into the draw to win our major prize, the stylish 5-door Holden Astra RS, valued at over $27,000. Thank you very much. And thanks to Holden. A MotoGP 2017 VIP experience, including a helicopter flight for two, valued at $4,000. Thanks to McDoon Inc. And a Midsummer Festival 2018 VIP package valued at $1,000 thanks to Midsummer Festival. And don't forget, anytime you simply donate across the Radiothon period, your donations of $2 or more are tax deductible. So it's a great way to support us while reducing your tax pay at the same time. Tax time, I should say. You'll also have the chance to win a luxury cruise. Head to joy.org.au for more info. But do it before June 30. Sign up or renew your membership for a chance to win. Donate and save money at tax time, or do both. We still need Joy, your voice, your radio station.
Joy.
You're here on Joy 94.9, Sunday Arts Magazine, with Brennan and Neil, and we're talking to Philip Adams at the moment about his start in the ballet world and what an interesting start that's been so far.
So we left you in Sydney, and let's go back to Sydney now. So you're dancing on the Mike Walsh Show. What is the next step or dance move for Philip Adams at that point?
Well, Sydney in the 80s, let's just start there. That was the time. A friend of a friend, as usual, recommended that I audition for the Victorian College of the Arts, and I'd never heard of the VCA.
So it wasn't on your radar
at
that point?
No, not by any stretch. And so I moved to Melbourne, auditioned for the VCA, got in. So we're in the late 80s now. And at the end of the course, I won the ANZ International Fellowship Award, which granted me an entry, which at that time, let's think about the ANZ International Art Award, which was quite prestigious, was $15,000. So that was enough to get me internationally. And so I chose to go to New York City at that time. I'm 23 years old, hadn't been anywhere on the planet in my life. I thought, yeah, dance capital of the world. Why not just move to New York with like not a care in the world as you do when you're 23 and land, and you knew a friend of a friend that you could stay in some apartment in the East Village. And I did that. And I stayed in New York for 10 years. And they were some of clearly the most influential years of my career growing up as a dancer living in the city.
And being in such fast-paced city, did it feel like a decade in New York?
It really did. Like, I think back now, I mean, I could sort of always see that, you know, the late 80s and the early 90s through social media lens these days. And we can't touch it in the way that it was just part of our DNA. Then it just now feels like so long ago. And those influential years of informing my career will certainly have rubbed off in the way that I make and create today as a choreographic and visual artist. So, I can remember some of the first jobs and auditions and workshops that I went to as if it was just yesterday. But that's still part of, clearly, you know, this relationship that I maintain with New York. And when I visit it today, it certainly is a different city. And it goes through many, many changes and phases. But that's the beauty of the greatest city in the world.
Yeah. And did you have, that fearless attitude that you began your career, you know, did you have that when you went to New York, or were you a little bit daunted by the whole situation?
I think I was always a risk taker.
Right.
And it wasn't about survival, and it wasn't about kind of being street smart. It was just something that innate in me that I always had this instinct that I knew I wanted to go to New York. I wanted to dance with that dance company, and I wanted to invest, those early informative years learning my craft. And so, yeah, I was just always knocking on doors and taking workshops. And eventually I landed a job with a really important dance company of the time called the Tricia Brown Dance Company. And, you know, they're well celebrated. And so for 10 years, I worked off and on with many independent artists and toured the world over and over and over until there was a time where I felt it's time to invest in, you know, the idea of moving back to Australia and breaking up with New York and letting go of, you know, my first lover in that way, which was the Big Apple. And so I moved back in the late 90s.
And was that, you know, a case of you felt like you'd gotten everything that you could from
pretty
that beautiful
much,
city?
Yeah, 10 years in the city, you're either going to go into therapy or you're going to stay, right? Yeah, so I decided to come back and invest in that you know, my career and developing here in Australia.
Because New York in the 80s obviously was a lot different to what New York is now. And so 10 years is quite a long time to be in a city like that. Mm. So by that stage, you know, did you feel like you had enough and that was...
Yeah, I really did. I feel like I'd run, you know, the course of my interest in working as a dancer, and there was not a lot of opportunity, especially financially in America, to become choreographic artist and sort of explore the way that you can make work with funding. And so I sniffed that out here in Australia as part of the way that I could obviously, you know, promise my career to be more of value in terms of working as a choreographic artist.
Okay, so you obviously did the research before you came back thinking there was more opportunities to develop.
By default. I kept getting more and more jobs at, you know, landing small commissions in Australia and teaching at the Victorian College of the Arts, et cetera. So there was sort of a slow comeback, but it was eventually time for me to move home.
And tell us about Australia at that point in time, though. Mm. You know, what was there a strong dance industry here?
There had developed in the late 90s a core major group of dance companies, the Sydney Dance Company, and the Australian Dance Theatre was always here, and the Australian Ballet, of course. Yep. But at that time, there wasn't really the milieu, we call it, of the new rise of choreographic artists that were beginning to introduce a new trend or a new movement in Australian dance history, post-postmodernism. So we did have a company in Melbourne, Danceworks, which was part of their sort of set that really invested in more experimental and performance and dance. And I was part of that company for a while. And so at that time, no, there wasn't really a lot that, but it was a time of growth in the dance industry. And so Chunky Move became part of the kind of the Melbourne institution of like flagship companies that were able to develop and establish themselves along with my good associate and friend, Lucy Guerin, Dance Inc. So I kind of grew up with all of that company structure, and now post all of that kind of long history of 10 years investment of my company and Chunky Move and Lucy Guerin Inc., we now have the rise of the independent sector, who have survived also, you know, a lot of cuts in the arts across the last, you know, as we know, this last 3 years. And so we see the independent company as the new arrival, as the new company, like independent choreographers and artists as the new companies, because they have to form their own ensemble as opposed to a company structure, and how we support them as more established organisations is super important.
So as founder and artistic director of Ballet Lab, you know, tell us a little bit about how that even came about to begin with, you know, that gap in time then.
Mm. It's an interesting name, isn't it, Ballet Lab? It's quite a conservative name, and for those that, you know, have seen my work or know me, I'm by no stretch a conservative artist. Certainly, if you want to call boundary pushing, the life would fall more into that category. And I think about the history of how Ballet Lab became into fruition is that I created this work in 1999 called Amplification. And it was sort of like the moment where I was introduced onto the map, the landscape. And this work dealt with trauma. It was, interestingly enough, it was about the 1.6 second association impact of a head-on collision, car accidents and being hit by a car. So clearly this childhood kind of resuscitation of my work. And so I, between sort of somewhere between visual art, performance art, and dance choreographic exploration, this work was a really big hit, and it has toured the world and still today celebrated and taught across the universities of Australia as part of the repertoire. And so people sort of always described my work as having this classicism to it, or this renaissance in the way that it has a queer content that twists narrative into otherness, shall we say. We use that word very loosely. And in saying otherness, I think that I do create these fantasies and these ideas where ballet could conceptually kind of move into more a laboratory or an experimental space. So Ballet Lab was just sort of arrived on my doorstep out of by default, really, in that people said it's sort of ballet, you know, and because you You know, you're predominantly raised through classical ballet in your training. And then today, what you do, Philip, is sits somewhere between experimental performance art and visual art practice.
And why do you think, you know, that kind of combination has, you know, really worked? Is it sort of a product of its time in that way? Like, was
it's
it
timeless.
Perfect timing?
It's timeless. Yeah, I feel like classicism is timeless, right. But it's how we reinvent or reestablish and reinterpret storybook ballet. You could really put it down to that through the lens of many experimental processes. And that's kind of where I began to really kind of engage more within the visual art sector. There was a lot of my work engages in visual art, and I work with like Brooke Andrew, I work with Patricia Piccinini, I work with Julia DeVille, and you know, I work with a list going on right through to our Australian iconic fashion designer Tony Matuszewski. So always from the beginning, I was working in these spaces which were influencing the way that my classical approach to experimental observation of work, objectification of work, and queerness in the way that it's just naturally part of who I am, became, yeah, Ballet Lab's main feature. Yeah.
Now, Philip Adams, we've got so much more to ask you. We'll be right back on Sunday Arts Magazine. It is Joy 94.9, and it's Radiothon time. Get on at joy.org.au.
That was Jesus and Mary Chain with Sometimes Always. And you're here on Joy 94.9 Sunday Arts
David Liss.
I know, exactly. It's very quiet this year without David.
It is. We're getting a word in edgewise today. But if you want to get a word in with us, 0427 Joy 949, you can SMS or you can email onair@joy.org.au. And I also did mention joy.org.au as our website where you can renew your membership or become a member if you haven't been part of the Joy family before, but we would love to have you.
Exactly.
We really would. Now, founder and artistic director of Ballet Lab, Philip Adams, it is such a pleasure to have you in the studio. We're not letting you go just yet because we're getting into the juicy part. Well, actually, all of your story is juicy, but we're talking about Ballet Lab, and it's been around since 1999. That is a long time for an arts organisation. Tell us a little bit about how it's evolved during that time.
Surely. Yes. Well, where do I start? I mean, beginning with grant applications to the Australia Council and Creative Victoria and every other foundation, and being like surviving that consistently over the last 15 years and with self-educated too as well along the way. What got me through that time, I think, mostly is that it's about the artist making the work to the conditions to which are available at that time in history. So I always found, even if I were not funded during a certain period of my life or like, you know, trying to survive as a company structure, I always found a way to make work. And that was through collaboration mostly. And I've always prided myself on that position where I'm able to reinvent the wheel and sort of offer a new way of looking at art and dance and culture. And it just so happens, and lucky me, after the malicious cuts to the Australia Council by George Brandis in 2015, and to which I was part of that, I lost all of my Australia Council funding organisational support out of nowhere. It was almost like it was, you know, some like a spell that had been brewing in the backdrop of Ballet Lab's archive. The Temperance Hall in South Melbourne, which historically is a very important building, Victorian building, built in 1863, founded by the Temperance Movement, came up for expression of interest for someone to put forward to Working Heritage, who are the caretaker of the building, to revitalise it. And my hand went up, and in an overnight expression of interest application that I submitted, I wrote this word, this sentence, this sort of vision that I just went, the Temperance Hall is a work of art. And that's what got me over the line in terms of the long conversation that we had with Working Heritage Victoria about preserving this building, but also allowing for the colourful cultural history which the hall has had since the Anthill Street Theatre was in there during the 80s and the 90s. And then it sort of becoming, after they had left the building, it became black in a way. It was just more of a rehearsal space or site that was starting to get really run down, mm-hmm. like really run down. And so the developer next door, who was building a nursing home, went to buy or inquire about the Temperance Hall, and it was discovered that the Temperance Hall sits on Crown land. It's historically preserved. Mm. You cannot knock that building over and build apartments. So that's where the story begins. Mm. So they put the tender out, and I, after a year process, got that tender and have moved my company, Philip Adams Ballet Lab, into the Temperance Hall. And may I say, it's such a perfect match for me, because if we think of the word temperance, which is, you know, about tolerance, no alcohol, and putting me in there, there's obviously clearly a contradiction, and it couldn't be a better marriage. It couldn't be a better marriage. So the word, you know, queerness and temperance are turbulent lovers, but we're finding a really great way to get along together at the Temperance Hall.
What does it do for you, you know, moving into a new space in terms of the company itself? Does it give you a new lease on what your company means and stands for?
It's life-changing for me. Certainly, I was looking at, you know, a very grim future. And it's been able to allow me to also at the mid-century, 52 years of age, think about the way I can support emerging artists, the way that the hall can bring to life a practice that is very interdisciplinary and not be a theatre model, not be a dance house or a malt house or an arts house model, but be the other model that's untying institution and allowing for the, you know, the you know, there's no risk out there enough for Temperance Hall. We are open, and we've always been a pillar. It was particularly my work for LGBTQIA+ culture. And so I feel like now the Temperance Hall is just another expansion for me to also support queer culture inside of this space as much as my work is presented in there. So I'm a theatre, I'm a gallery, I'm a venue, but I'm also a white box, flexible enough now to support what the artist's conditions to what they require.
And with queer content, you know, it's always in quotation marks, you know, something that is made for queer audiences. Mm. Do you find now in 2017, you know, even the mainstream audience is kind of interested in queer texts? Mm. What does that do for dance in that sort of realm? Is it, do you have the ability to push things even further than they already are? Mm. You know, how does it change the dynamic there?
Aren't you on trend?
Mm.
Yeah. I think queer culture, you know, it's all about the generation that are available at Entremont of the day, of the time, and how that affects the way that their work is then perceived. So it's almost like you've been handed the baton in some queer fertility. Mm. I was talking to my good friend Paul Yaw, who's a visual artist, about this, and he talks about the inherited genetic fertility of queerness and how each generation has a response, a responsibility to handing that information on to the way that queerness is then adapted. And clearly in the 90s it became so commercial. It became more, about drag, and it became camp, and, you know, and then the epidemic of the AIDS epidemic of the 80s and the 90s certainly put a very strong hold around the politicisation of queer culture. And for me, it's, you know, queerness is not an act to which I sort of willfully explore in my work, but it just so happens that I have a big interest in finding alternative methods, etc. Like, for example, we have a fabulous patron, and I rely heavily on private donation and patronage, by a doctor who is a specialist in sleep called Dr. Marcus McMahon. And he has awarded our company a gift for 5 years of $12,000 towards a visual artist who will explore the parameters of their practice, which is a transitional phase to which can it go outside the visual art context and look at how performative culture or how the Temperance Hall can be available to them to bring in the mechanism of movement or action. So if they're a painter, a sculptor, or a visual maker, and how that can be then as broadly experimented as far as they can. And these sort of awards are very rare. These don't come up out of nowhere, and patrons just don't pop up out of, you know, for no reason. And so it, for me, getting back to the Temperance Hall and the idea of how it symbolizes change in the community and society, is that we now need to be more clever with the way we present and promote artistic culture in this city, because it really, let's face it, Melbourne is that space. where we've always had that paradigm shift, whether you're up a staircase in Brunswick looking at something, you know, by an artist that's sort of beginning their practice, through to entering the Melbourne Arts Centre or going down the road to ACCA. But now you can go to Temperance Hall to discover another space, a grey space, a queer space, an experimental space, which is even more flexible than the institutions to which govern a lot of the more shopping mall mentality, yeah. shall we say. Yeah.
And what does something like technology do to, you know, the world of dance as well, in terms of the visual arts and the whole holistic kind of vision?
Yeah. Well, the technology has certainly informed dance and, well, not just dance or theatre or, you know, all arts industries. And I think it's had its reign. I think that, yeah, it coming back to the purity of dance is obviously is one of the most wonderful experiences one can have as a theatre goer, to have live music and dance. And if I look at the masters of contemporary dance history, such as Merce Cunningham and John Cage, and then the way that, like, towards the end of his life was working more with a method of technology which introduced a technique in his work called life form. That was at a point where he couldn't move anymore. He relied on technology as much as a god, as William Forsythe is, the director of the Frankfurt Ballet, you know, worked with technology. But then as you mature and you become more interested in, mature artist syndrome here at 52, you just become more responsible and attuned to what it is that you want to narrate about your work and to who and your audience. And for me, looking at the technology has never really been a major part of those conditions to which I make. But now where I see myself being, I guess, more closer to who I am as an artist and what is it I want to do, it's connection with audience. It's bringing them closer to the experience of what it feels like to be in a performative mechanism or provoked by one of the most outrageous ideas that I could possibly conjure up in my collaborative practice. And that includes, you know, having total nude performances where you don't come into the room unless you are naked with 100 other people to ignite the space, as much as works at the moment I'm presenting, which with the Melbourne Chamber Orchestra, to Richard Strauss' Metamorphosen, that play live on stage whilst in the entire room becomes an inflatable mattress for paint. So I'm sort of, I work at such polemic ends of my madness and my interest in my childhood. Fascinating backdrop as we started this conversation. And I draw all those wonderful backdrops into these ballets, these narratives. And I've used woodchoppers, I've used architects, I've used fashion designers, you know, and now, maybe to end this conversation, I'm using a live spiritual medium, a clairvoyant in the room, in order to draw a conversation with the dead, so that the audience, when they come to see this work, and this sounds crazy and sort of outrageous in the way that, would you believe it or not, I'm trying to find some position for what is dance today. And I think Ballet Lab, the name, even though as tradition as it is, has this rambunctious and turbulent conservative space in order for me to explore now what is the Temperance Hall.
I like that.
Yeah, I felt like I just gave some lecture.
It was like a lecture, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was very interesting, Harlan. Yeah. And it's just how it all comes back to it.
Yeah, it's like, going back to my childhood in that way. I'm still telling child's story. I'm still entertaining mum and dad in the living room, dressing up in my mother's clothes and with a, you know, putting on a pantomime show in the evening time between, you know, meals. It's just that people pay money to see it now.
Well, and now you have a new venue to sort of, you know, to actually...
Yeah, I have, I have this space in front of me to really, you know, I feel like there was nowhere for me to really go anymore. Mm. I mean, my work had become just so specific to a practice that was almost unprogrammable, not completely. And I have had a lot of success internationally, and I've been presented every venue could possibly think of. But I now require my own space, a space where I can live out that fantasies as much as I can support young, emerging practice, particularly in queer space. And we've just presented Mr. Jack Ferver from New York, and that was a really big success. He was also a queer-based New York artist that was on Joy FM a couple of weeks ago. And it was sold out, and it was fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Are you sort of thankful in a way that your creative well, you know, has still got plenty left in it, shall we say? You know, is it something that you're able to step back and say, I still have a passion for it, it's still something that drives me?
I hope that I leave this planet still making art, and wherever I go in the afterlife, it'll be even be more interesting. Yeah. I'm never shy of an idea, and I'm just so open to conversation where I can expand my practice and introduce ideas and educate myself, as opposed to repeating form. And I think that's why we're talking earlier about the dance in the 90s. It certainly had a position in its postmodern, at the end of postmodernism, especially art as well in the art world. And then it became much more homogenized. It became really biennale. It became everybody's access and everybody can be an artist moment. You know what I'm saying?
I do. Now, back to sort of like what's happening currently, you know, what's sort of the outlook for Ballet Lab at the moment? Mm. You know, where are you looking forward to?
Yeah, well,
you've mentioned a few things, in terms of an overall view.
Yeah, well, we are fortunate enough to be supported by Creative Victoria as part of their appointment of organisations on 4 years recurrent funding. So that really presents a healthy pool of money for us for an organisation to exist at Temperance Hall. And I have also opened an Airbnb associated with the hall, which is completely and utterly sold out constantly and in demand because it's filled with my art collection as much as all of my mid-century 1950s and 60s Australian furniture. And so it's a real, when you enter the Temperance Hall, I'm just talking about the future, we're entering what is going to be a legacy, that it will be left as a destination in South Melbourne and a pillar. Like, you could almost say I'm making a museum, not as fabulous as Mona and David Walsh's dream, but a micro version where you can see the most cutting edge work that I can now be making as much as I want to present and promote across the Victoria, and especially Melbourne-based artists, think locally. I don't have world domination the way I used to when I was young. I have local support domination.
Yeah, but you use the word legacy, though. That's an important thing. At the start of the show, I was talking about the Whiteley documentary and his widow essentially set up a museum to sort of celebrate and create a legacy for such an important artist. So is it kind of a privilege to set up your own in a way and be able to interact with people in that space as well?
Absolutely. You couldn't have said it better. And you could think of it, it's almost like a cinema. When you enter the Temperance Hall, and those that have come into the Temperance Hall recently that I've invited to either develop work there or present work there, they say, Philip, it's like you've finally found your David Lynch film. Like, you really are in some kind of dreamscape in here, and it's magical. And so we always, this rainbow that flies over Temperance, you know, covers Temperance Hall, and that's really important, particularly at the moment that I know the government, or under the Minister for the Arts, Martin Foley, has launched a new campaign on combating homophobia. And we are applying for that grant, and we're really excited about methods to reach the idea of combating homophobia to the broadest audience possible through Temperance Hall. So, you know, there are many roads, especially in the number one tram, which drove right past it.
And, you know, that kind of gets into the political realm as well. Is that something that, you know, you'll continue to fight for, whether it's equality or, you know, just social issues in general?
Absolutely. You know, we're talking about the other day, and I hope we've got enough time to just drop this
we
one in.
We certainly can.
That it's 40 years next year, the rainbow flag celebrates its origins. It was launched in 1978 in San Francisco. And we think about how would we replace that flag here in Victoria to represent an up-to-date contemporary flag of that represents all people of race and gender and issue and equality politics. So that's one of the things that we intend to do, is to sort of have a new flag for the state flag. That sort of doesn't replace the rainbow flag, but sort of introduces who we are today and the way we would, you know, completely, you know, tolerant of this. And so the Temperance Hall goes past just being a venue that's going to present cutting edge art and performance and dance. It's actually a political space for people to get really charged up and activate as much as they can and protest for queerness and for equality. So we're really excited about the idea of putting this application in to the new Combating Homophobia Social Impact Program.
Okay. Now, before we let you go as well, we haven't mentioned what we were going to mention at the start of the show, Ms. Minogue. Kylie, a big fan of Joyce. You had something to do with her, didn't you?
David normally starts every show by playing the locomotion. And if we don't leave with playing the locomotion, I'll be disappointed. For the listeners out there, I'm laughing and blushing at the same time. I'm trying to remember the year. Do you remember the year, Brendan?
It wasn't 88, was it? No.
I think it was 87, maybe. Kylie Minogue launched the locomotion. It was filmed at Essendon Airport. I was a student at the time with Tanya Lacey and a couple of others, and we choreographed the locomotion. I danced in it, and I can still remember Kylie with that fabulous permanent hair. She's just off Neighbours. We really didn't know what we were doing, but if you look back at the video, it is a hoot. I had dark hair. I was the one on the right in the black.
Okay, narrows it down, because I did actually watch the video clip this morning because I knew you were coming. I thought, David's mentioned this a few times, so I was trying to pick out which one is Philip. Okay, so
I had dark hair on the right, all in black. Okay. I was 20 years old. I don't know, but you know, my mum still stands proud that my son was in the locomotion video by Kylie Minogue. I think I should put it on my bio now. Philip started out dancing with Kylie in 1980, whatever it was, in the locomotion.
A little plaque in Timbers Hall.
Yes. I was also in another one. Now we're going to get closer to it all. I've Got to Be Certain. And that was filmed at Rosati's. Okay. Yeah, so we upgraded a bit from Essendon Airport to a swank city establishment cafe. But I have to think back again, those 80s and how it all began. And yeah. I'm still here in Melbourne, and now I have my own venue, and I don't want to call it a theatre, or I don't want to call it a museum or a gallery or whatever, you know, we need. I call it a space, because that's where artists at their best, they just need space.
And everything sort of, you know, worked out pretty well for you, Philip.
Oh, I've dodged some bullets over the years, I'm sure. That's maybe part of also tenacity of being an artist and you know.
Yeah. But you know, Philip Adams of today, you know, artistic heavyweight, what would you tell Philip in 1987? If you had some sage advice for him.
Oh, hard question.
Get a perm like Kylie.
I like the idea of, like, if I could go back in time and, you know, change history, I wouldn't for one second, because I absolutely loved every moment of being a younger artist, a mid-career artist, and now a senior artist. So I'd look back at that Philip and thank them. Yeah, for pounding the pavement in New York, you know, and living in squalor but loving every minute of it, going to see the craziest stuff and putting myself in risky situations where I think, how did I end up in the meatpacking district at 3 a.m. at this club, which I come out, you know, and there's not even a cab to get home. And then, you know, moving home and whatever I, you know, have gone through in this last 3 decades of contributing to the cultural life of Victoria. Yeah, I think my best work's yet to come. Oh, yeah, I'm now making my work. It takes a long time.
That's wonderful. Yeah. Well, how can people find out more information about the work you're creating at the moment?
It's really interesting. We've got, we will be premiering a work in October, which you'll be announced shortly. Mm-hmm. And, also, my website is a very easy access point to, you know, balletlab.com. But interesting, just maybe we can end on this note, that in August this year, we are opening the Temperance Hall website. So we're going through a rebranding right now of what does that look like? Mm-hmm. What does that represent? And inside of the Temperance Hall matrix, that website, Ballet Lab will be buried in there, as I am the artistic director. So this is what I can say is there's a great change coming up. How does Ballet Lab transition to become Temperance Hall? And it seems perfect. Ballet, classicism, mm-hmm. conservatism, ballet, temperance, stronghold, no tolerance. So in a way, it's like they marry each other, and laboratory becomes hall. So in a way, it's a perfect match. It just seems that it you know, as Creative Victoria staff had said when they were assessing my application, they went, now that's the perfect marriage, Philip. That's your home. And you will continue to exist there until you can't anymore. So they put me in the nursing home next door, probably. Yeah, but I'll come and see work there, right?
Exactly.
I'll come next door.
I'm sure it'll be access available for wheelchairs as well. So
I had my first work ever presented at Temperance Hall in October coming up, which is really special.
Literally watch this space, Temperance Hall, and Ballet Lab. Thank you so much again, Philip Adams, for coming in. You've got so much to talk about, so we'll have to have you in again very, very soon. Fantastic. And you came at last minute to see
always.
Us.
Always. I never miss a social media grateful. Moment. I am always there.
So what's the website again that people get onto?
www.balletlab.com.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Philip Adams. It's an absolute pleasure.
And this is just for you, Philip.
I'm going out on
thought you would never ask.
Let's get the hands ready. Let's do the locomotion.
Exactly.
Joy. You're on Joy 94.9. Sunday Arts Magazine is the show. Take you through to 5 p.m. It's Brendan and Neil with you today. We're Davidless today, but big shout out to him. He's having a bit of fun.
Exactly. I'm sure he's having a good time as well.
Well deserved. And someone else that's having fun out there, the lovely Donna Frock from Eagle Hawk. We always love to hear from you, Donna. Wonderful to hear Philip Adams, an inspirational man working at the heart of our community, making things happen and proving ballet is accessible to all. It's tougher than football. It's art and sport.
Thank you, Donna.
Now, if you haven't become a member yet or renewed your membership, head to joy.org.au and follow the really simple, things to do.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.